Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
So why are people moral relativists? I want to focus on two main reasons why someone may be a relativist. There are other reasons, but we only have so much time, and these are the ones that I hear the most frequently and are most found in the literature. One is that there's just too much diversity on moral issues both in and across cultures. And secondly, it is intolerant to believe that one's moral view is universally true and others wrong. We'll call the first one the argument from disagreement, and the second one, the argument from tolerance. So first, the argument from disagreement. So disagreement on moral issues is everywhere. In the United States alone, there is an array of questions over which sincere citizens hold contrary views, and they feel very strongly about those views. I mean, we can recite them nearly by heart, right? Abortion, marriage, physician-assisted suicide, the scope of religious liberty, animal rights, you know, these are the questions about our culinary practices. Is vegetarianism the right view, right? Is it morally permissible to eat animals? All these issues we're aware of. Internationally, it's no different. While some cultures practice polygamy and prohibit the killing and eating of cattle, to cite but two, other cultures practice monogamy and open up steak joints. So the disagreement is fairly deep. But not only is there disagreement across space, there's a disagreement across time. Think of all the civilizations throughout history that thought it was perfectly permissible to enslave fellow human beings, torture heretics, or rape and pillage conquered nations. And so not only is there a disagreement geographically, there's disagreement chronologically. Now, given the wide diversity of moral opinions and practices across space and time, it's easy to see why someone would be a moral relativist. It should not surprise us then that the two most widely read, widely published essays defending relativism that are found in a sort of typical of ethics textbook are by Ruth Benedict and William Graham Sumner, both social scientists of some note. Sumner lived in the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th, and Ruth Benedict did most of her work in the 20th century. They both appeal to this diversity in making their cases. They essentially argue that because there is a wide disagreement on moral beliefs and practices, there is no universal objective morality, and thus moral relativism is true. Now, I think that the argument of from disagreement is initially impressive, right? Who can deny the fact? It's based on an undeniable fact. There is deep moral disagreement. But I think if we start asking critical questions, its weaknesses will show up. So I want to go over four problems with the argument from disagreement. First, as a matter of simple logic, the fact of moral disagreement does not entail moral relativism. Just as the fact of disagreement about the shape of the earth doesn't mean the earth doesn't have a shape. Right? People disagree on a variety of matters. Why wouldn't it be possible that maybe some individuals and cultures got things wrong, right? Which is something I think we down deep really believe, right? So who, for example, would say that what the Nazis did to the Jews was morally permissible because their culture said it was right, or that racial segregation as once practiced in the southern United States was not immoral because the society at the time believed it was okay? So even though we may appeal to disagreement as a kind of defense of relativism, you know, if we, in our more reflective moments, we think it can't be. It doesn't follow from disagreement that nobody's right, because we can think of cases where we actually think there is disagreement and some people got it wrong. Right? We can even think of our own lives, right? Your own sort of journeys. There's lots of things that I believed when I was 18 that I don't believe anymore, right? And I'd like to think I've improved, and maybe I didn't. Maybe I've now, maybe the views I hold now may turn out to be wrong. But people do change over time, right? And we'd like to believe that, in a sense, we can grow and develop. So from strictly logical point of view, disagreement in and of itself is not enough to prove or to establish relativism. I mean, to put it this way, imagine you said, so you think of an argument like all bachelors are unmarried, Al Gore is a bachelor, therefore Al Gore is unmarried. The conclusion follows from those premises, right? Once you know those two premises, boom, you know that Al Gore is unmarried or a bachelor, right? So this argument, from the fact of disagreement, it doesn't do that sort of thing, right? It doesn't immediately, you don't go, oh, ha-ha, you know, it turns out that morality must be relevant, because you could just sort of plug in the premise, right? Some people get it wrong. Why wouldn't that be surprising to us? Second problem is that in order for the argument from disagreement to work, and this is a kind of a subtler objection, in order for the argument from disagreement to work, the moral relativist must assume this proposition. Whenever there is disagreement on any issue, for example, the correct moral position on X, just plug in any issue, there is no universal objective truth on the matter. Right, so to use disagreement as the basis for relativism requires that you accept a further belief. And that further belief is that whenever people disagree on something, therefore nobody's right. Well, at this point, you can simply announce your disagreement with the proposition that whenever there's disagreement on any issue, there's no universal objective truth on the matter. That, in other words, you just say, well, I disagree with that. And since you've just said that whenever there's any disagreement on a proposition or a particular view, therefore there's no correct view on the matter, well, then that's my reason to reject your principle. And that's what philosophers call a self-refuting claim. Right? It's like saying something, I can't speak a word in English, or don't believe anything I say. Or if, let's say, I had a shirt that said, the statement on the back of the shirt is false, and on the back of the shirt, the statement on the front of the shirt is true. So it's or if I say I have a brother who's an only child, I actually do have a brother who thinks he's an only child. So when we were just a little joke here, when my mom was alive, we were all hanging out at Christmas, and I asked her, I said, well, how was it to, When you gave birth to Patrick, that's our brother, how was it to undergo a C-section? She goes, I didn't have a C-section. I said, well, how'd you get the halo out? It was funnier at Christmas dinner, I guess. So, all right. Third problem with the argument of disagreement is that disagreement is overrated. Disagreement is overrated. So take, for example, the issue of abortion. That's an issue. It's pretty clear. People that identify as pro-life and pro-choice disagree on the morality of abortion. There's no doubt about that. But they don't disagree on the principle that it is morally wrong to intentionally kill innocent persons. What they disagree on is what counts as a person or how we should understand the meaning of innocence. So defenders of abortion rights typically argue either that the fetus, though genetically a human being, is not morally a person during most, if not all, of its gestation, or that the fetus, though morally a person, is not technically innocent if it is trespassing in the mother's body without her explicit consent. So you find in the literature on abortion, people that defend different views on it, different what are sometimes called decisive moments in fetal development. You'll have some philosophers argue that the fetus becomes a moral subject at, well, some argue conception, others detection of brain waves, others argue when sentience occurs, others argue when the fetus reaches a point of its brain, reaches a point of organized cortical brain activity. Others argue that when it has a self-concept. So there's all sorts of arguments that people offer in order to justify pregnancy termination. But those arguments, though, in order to show that the fetus is not a moral subject, assume that if it were, there'd be something wrong with abortion. Right, and so the point of those arguments is to in fact make a case for why it isn't wrong. Right now, I mentioned there are some philosophers who argue that even if the fetus is a person, abortion is still permitted. And in that case, the argument there's actually a very famous article published in 1971 by Judith Jarvis Thompson called "A Defense of Abortion," in which she argues that. She uses several illustrations or analogies, the most famous of which is the argument from being hooked up to an unconscious famous violinist. You're at a, you get abducted by the Society of Music Lovers who have canvassed all the available medical records in the world and discovered you and you alone have the right blood type to help this ailing violinist. You only have to be hooked up for 9 months. And so what happens is you wake up in bed and you discover you're there, and the doctor comes up to you and says, look, all violinists are persons. It's wrong to kill persons, so you can't unplug yourself from the violinist. And Thompson says, wouldn't you consider this outrageous? Right? And so there she's saying that unless there's explicit consent, it's a form of kind of like bodily trespassing. Right? So again, Thompson is trying to come up with a justification and doesn't actually deny the pro-life premise that it is wrong to intentionally kill innocent persons. She's arguing that the fetus isn't innocent in the technical sense that it is trespassing even if it didn't intend to do anything. Right? So the point is, using that as an example, is that there... on that particular issue, the disagreement is over these deeper, what are called metaphysical questions, like questions about who and what are we and whether we can know it, and not really on the moral principle. In fact, in a weird way, the fact that people offer these arguments means that they kind of do accept the moral principle. Right? They're trying to come up with justifications. Now, Catholics think that those sorts of arguments are flawed and mistaken. But it's important to recognize here is that the advocates of those arguments already agree with opponents of abortion that it is morally wrong to kill innocent persons. So this kind of reasoning can be applied to other issues as well. If you think of the debates over marriage, physician-assisted suicide, debates about curriculum in public schools and parental rights and religious liberty that are just out there and people are arguing about them all the time. One of the things that stands out is the differing factions in these debates appeal to the exact same moral goods: fairness, justice, relief of suffering, love, application, protection of the vulnerable. Where they disagree over is the proper application of those particular goods and principles and the right way to answer questions about the nature of the reality to which they are being applied. Now, this is why in the Catholic Catechism, there's a passage in there that says this, even though objective morality is known by all, quote, it is not perceived by everyone clearly and immediately. In the present situation, sinful man needs grace and revelation so moral and religious truths may be known by everyone with facility, with firm certainty, and with no admixture of error, unquote. So the Catholic Church teaches the idea that human beings have an awareness of something called the natural moral law, but it also tries to account for the fact why people disagree. Now, most people who aren't Catholics would not use terms like sinful man needs grace and revelation. That's very Thomistic way of talking about it. But other people who may not share the Catholic faith may say there's all sorts of reasons why people disagree on moral questions. They disagree because they hold differing views of human nature, such as in the issue of abortion. They also could have self-interest, right? And people can be affected by their emotions and their upbringing in ways that distort their perception of the natural law. So I know that all my students know that plagiarism is wrong, right? They know it, and yet some of them still do it. In fact, I had a student once whose plagiarism was so bad, not even his sin was original. Wow. That's funnier than. Why do they do it? Well, they're drawn emotionally, right? They think, well, I don't really care about philosophy, or I have to take this class and I don't want to, or there's more interesting things for me to do, so I'll cheat, right? So sometimes people can be caught up in emotions and do dumb things, right, that they know are wrong. So what the church is teaching is that, in fact, it offers an account of why people have a kind of rudimentary awareness of the natural law, but may get it wrong sometimes. Right. And we could think of that from our, I can only speak from my own experience. There are times where I have confused, my anger has distorted the way I make moral judgments, right? And so you just know from personal experience that sometimes, even when you're aware of certain moral principles, you can be affected deeply by circumstances, right? And so that's all that is saying. Fourth, the argument from disagreement has absurd consequences. So if moral relativism is correct, that there is no objective, universal objective morality, then it is not wrong everywhere and always to rape another person, intentionally kill the innocent, torture children for fun, judge Mother Teresa as no better than Adolf Hitler, and abandon one's infant offspring to the elements if one finds them inconvenient. So if moral relativism is in fact the case, it leads to these kind of absurd consequences that most people would find, hopefully, repugnant, right? So why do I appeal to this? Here's why. Like, a lot of times when discussing issues like this or questions, the thing that I think we have to resist is somebody telling you how you're supposed to think about something and thinking that you have the burden. So if somebody tells you, let's say you're at has anyone ever been to a marriage encounter before? Most of you aren't married anyway. So when I was younger, my wife had me go to a marriage encounter. It's where married couples go kind of do a retreat and they listen to speakers and write down their feelings in blue books. And they exchange those blue books with each other and then talk about it. And you learn to say things like, if I'm understanding you right, that kind of stuff, right? So imagine I'm at a marriage encounter and there's a speaker up there talking about, says something like, a good wife washes her husband's socks by hand. So imagine you're sitting there and let's say I'm sitting there with my wife. She at that point will elbow me in the chest and say something. Why? Because I know my wife is good and she doesn't do that. In other words, if relativism leads to these absurd consequences, why can't that be a good reason to reject relativism? I mean, we do that all the time, right? We rely on what we know to reject what somebody's theory says tells us we should say, think something else. So imagine a case like this. I mean, this is a weird case. Imagine, let's say, a criminal law case where you're falsely accused of a crime, but you happen to fit the description perfectly, and all the evidence actually points to you having done it, although you know subjectively you didn't do it. So it could be a weird situation where you have reason to reject the evidence because your first person experience is that you know you didn't do it, but the jury actually is justified in convicting you, right? So, I mean, think about that in terms of, so someone comes to you with the theory of relativism. If you are fairly confident that these things are wrong, that's a good reason to reject relativism, even if the other person is not convinced. So think about some of the other unintended or not or absurd consequences. It also means that there can be neither moral progress nor moral reformers. Right? So if morality is simply reducible to whatever the culture says now, then you can't say we're getting better. Right? You can't say that, for example, Martin Luther King Jr. Is a hero, right? It doesn't make any sense. In other words, you can't get better unless there's some goal or end to which that's achievable in some way. These are sometimes called the problem of moral reformation. That is, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, we can think of just in human history, we'd like to think that when certain things have changed, we've gotten better. We'd also like, sometimes we've gotten worse, right? It's just, but those kind of judgments only make sense if in fact there's something like an objective morality. Let me move on to the second argument. So that's just basically, that's the argument from disagreement and some of the criticisms leveled against it. The argument from tolerance. So here, the argument goes something like this. So some people argue that because it is intolerant to believe that one's moral views are right and others wrong, it follows that moral relativism, the view that there is no one universal objective morality, best establishes tolerance. So this thinking was actually quite popular or what had real influence back in the 60s through the 80s in a public school curriculum called values clarification. Has any of you ever heard of values clarification? This was it was one of those kind of fads in education theory. These three education professors published a book called Values Clarification, and it was a way to teach kids about ethics, but in a way that would make them more tolerant and open to students who disagree with them. And they would give these kind of scenarios that were like almost unanswerable, like lifeboat scenarios. Like, you're in a lifeboat, there's 10 people, and only 7 can live, or 5 can live, and it's your job to choose who doesn't get to get on the lifeboat. And everyone's different, right? So you have like a lawyer, a doctor, a street cleaner, like all these people from different professions and background and ages, and you're supposed to make a judgment about that, right? And one of the criticisms about scenarios like that is that they're so artificial that why don't we use actual real cases like that really happened? So if you've ever seen the movie, the original movie, not Titanic, which I don't like. I call it Jack and Rose's Excellent Adventure. But the original one called A Night to Remember, which is an old black and white movie from the 50s, and there's a real lifeboat scenario there. Right, I mean, people. The Titanic is sinking, and you immediately know who the virtuous people are. Right, the person that the guy that says, "I'm going to stay here with my wife," even though, the wife says, you know, they'll say, "Women and children first." That's the way they talked back then, and wife says, "No, I'm going to stay with my husband." Right, and then you have some guy disguise himself as a woman so he can be taken off the ship, and you immediately realize that person is not a nice person, right? And then you see the band or the orca on the ship moving from sort of big band tunes to hymns, right? So you recognize that immediately. So in any event, this kind of thinking about relativism and tolerance really was deeply influential in this 1960s through 80s public school curriculum. But there's several reasons why I think we should reject this argument. First problem is that the moral relativist seems to be affirming at least one absolute moral principle, tolerance. So, but in that case, she's no longer a relativist. All right, so if you say that the reason why we should be relativist is because it'll make society more tolerant. You're saying that there's a moral principle that all people are obligated to abide by, which sounds an awful lot like some form of moral objectivism. Right, so first problem is just the fact that it doesn't seem that there's not a really good fit between relativism and tolerance. Second problem is why believe that moral relativism leads to tolerance? I mean, I'll tell you what made me think about this objection. It's only been about 3 years since I've included this, is that I read a book, reviewed a book for a university press. If you're one of the cool things about being a professor is you get invited by publishers to read manuscripts, and you can make a decision about or make a recommendation whether the book should be published or make suggestions. And they usually pick a topic or a book for you to, or a manuscript for you to read that's something that's within your area of specialty. So you get to actually see, oh, wow, this is interesting. This is going to be coming out. And it's kind of fun to do. I like doing that. Not maybe some professors don't, but I very much like doing that. Well, I got invited by a major press, university press, to review a manuscript. And I'm not going to mention the author or the name of the book. It wound up getting published, and I actually recommended it be published, and I had a lot of comments. I didn't agree with the author about much of what he had said, but one of the things I think you have to do when you're reviewing manuscripts is that don't let your own views bias you against a good work. In any event, in the book, the guy is defending a kind of, like, he's making an argument for forms of nationalism, political nationalism. And it's a view, I have problems with the view myself, but it was interesting. At one point he said, I'm a moral relativist, at the very beginning of the book. And he said, and so for that reason, I just love my own culture and nation, and I don't care about anybody else's. And then I thought to myself, oh, I never thought of it that way before, that like you could actually, here's a guy saying that I'm a relativist and that's why I don't want to be tolerant, right? He basically is saying, although I believe all morality is culturally relative, I prefer my culture's morality to all others, and thus I want my nation to ban all immigrants and other cultural forms from existing. So in other words, there's nothing about relativism or that gets you tolerance. In fact, in this case, you get quite the opposite. And third problem is that the practice of tolerance seems valuable because it establishes certain goods, such as living at peace with others and better understanding those with whom one disagrees. But these goods seem to be functioning as if they were part of some universal objective morality, which is inconsistent with moral relativism. In other words, what's the point of being tolerant and listening to other people? You can learn something, right? You can acquire maybe an insight into something you didn't have before, and that's good. Or maybe you don't change your mind, but you learn. You nevertheless better understand somebody's view with whom you disagree, and that enhances your own flourishing, right? You're better off having that knowledge and appreciation. Or it could be that the other person, after conversations with you, says, oh, I never thought of it that way before. And maybe they've adjusted their views, right? So those seem to be objective goods, and it makes sense, right? Also, you can't really be tolerant of people unless you disagree with them, right? It was right after I published a book with Cambridge University Press on the abortion controversy back in 2007, and I got all these invites to speak on college radio stations, and I was in one, Iowa State, which is the Cyclones, by the way. What kind of mascot is that? I mean, it's like a natural disaster. It's like having, you know, like the plague. It's a weird, I don't understand. Okay, so Iowa State, I'm being interviewed, and this guy calls up. It's one of these call-in shows, and he says, "The problem with you, Beckwith, is that you're intolerant. You think you're right, and everyone else is wrong." And I said, well, am I wrong in thinking that way? He said, yes. I go, well, you're in the same position as me then. You think you're right and I'm wrong. How do we actually differ, right? So the reason why tolerance makes sense, at least you can only be tolerant of views you think are wrong, right? You're tolerant of people, right? You treat them with respect and dignity, and you listen to them, and those are all virtues, right? And so if anything, tolerance seems to not be established. It can't really be established without these virtues. So that's the argument from tolerance. So let me just wrap things up and say a little bit about politics and moral relativism. And here I'm going to bring up a few insights from the namesake of the Thomistic Institute, St. Thomas Aquinas. Aquinas believed that there was such a thing called the natural law. And what he meant by that was that, in fact, he had this whole right way to put it. He kind of had a view of a kind of architecture of the law, that there were different types of law. There was what he called the eternal law, which is the kind of God's blueprint of the universe and, you know, the order of things. And then there's something called the human law. What he means there is simply what we would say today called the positive law, you know, sort of the ordinary law that we're aware of, criminal and civil law, that are created by governments and states, right? And then there's what he calls the divine law, which is, for him, the Bible, essentially. And that's something you can only know through sort of God revealing it. And then there's the natural law. And the natural law is what human beings can know about their own good. And because we're rational, we have the ability to reason, unlike other creatures, we can actually come to conclusions about what's good for us. And over time, these conclusions find themselves in the human law in one way or another. So Aquinas argues that we're rational creatures with natural inclinations to pursue what we believe is good, preserve our lives, beget and educate children, know truths about the world and the divine law, and live in a community at peace with our neighbors. And it's very bare bones, what Aquinas says in the Summa Theologica on the natural law, but it's basically saying that there are these sort of fundamental, he uses the term inclination. He doesn't mean it like instinct. He's kind of saying we're ordered towards these goods. And so it makes sense why human law is going to reflect those goods. So we have all sorts of laws against homicide and theft. And we have laws about property and trespassing and obligations that parents have to children. All these things are reflections in one way or another of the natural law. And so it's not an accident that all cultures and societies, even when they disagree on certain matters, still in the broad sense have based on these sort of undergirding goods. It's something that's presupposed when we speak of human rights and unjust laws. And think, for example, of the Universal Declaration on Human Rights or Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from a Birmingham jail. By the way, when I teach on that, I teach a course at Baylor called Contemporary Moral Problems, and I have my students read King's letter along with the Credo. I don't know if you've ever, the Credo, which is a Platonic dialogue, it's Socrates is about to die or take, you know, he was given a death sentence because of corrupting the youth. And he's kind of, I don't want to say, he's kind of in jail. And his friend Credo there comes to try to talk him out of it. And it's one of the coolest things to have students read King from 1963 and Plato, how many years, but 2,400 years earlier. And yet they're actually talking about some of the same fundamental questions of justice and the right thing to do in your relation to the state. And so they're two individuals separated by 2,500 years, and yet they're part of the same conversation. And they're both in jail. And so it's pretty cool to go over that. All right, so one other thing about Aquinas' view is that it can account for our deep disagreements. And I've already alluded to this. So think, for example, of it is morally wrong to kill another person without justification. Now, all societies prohibit homicide, but we carve out exemptions, and we do so by justifying them. Think about something like it's morally wrong to intentionally tell a falsehood to someone who's entitled to the truth. The requirement of truth-telling is universally affirmed. People argue for exemptions. I think, for example, in military actions, right? Misinformation happens all the time. Is that a violation of the principle of requirement of truth-telling? People in the military who attend University of Alabama, Birmingham, sometimes come to class, I know at Baylor they do, in camouflage. And are they trying to hide from me? They should get desk camouflage. That would be big. Whoa, I could... Or chair camouflage. In any event, the point is that Aquinas' view sort of captures this idea that we have these sort of in common inclinations, and yet he also tries to account for disagreement. So let me just conclude by saying, I think moral relativists typically have their hearts in the right place. They rightly recognize differences of moral beliefs and practices between individuals and across cultures, while at the same time wanting to advance the cause of tolerance and understanding. But as we've seen, despite their good motives, the view they hold, moral relativism, has many significant weaknesses. Thank you very much. Yeah.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.